Okay, let's start this press briefing here in Geneva, the United Nations. Today is Tuesday, 5th of August. And I'd like to start immediately by welcoming our guests from UNICEF and UN Women that are here to brief you on the situation in Sudan. We have first James Elder with Sheldon Yett, who is the UNICEF representative in Sudan, who is calling in from Port Sudan. Welcome, sir. Thank you very much for being with us. And we have Salvatore Nkurunziza, who is the UN Women representative for Sudan, also from Port Sudan, to tell us about the situation of female-headed households. We also have with us Sophia Kaltrop from the Geneva office in case there are questions. So I'd like to start immediately by giving them the floor, and then we will open the floor to questions. So let's start directly with UNICEF. James, you want to start, or we go straight to Sheldon? Sorry, you are still muted. You have to unmute yourself, James. Not working? Let me look at my colleagues there. Yeah, you're on.
Okay, there we are. No, look, it should go straight to Sheldon just to say he's been to some frontline areas where that have been cut off for a long, long time. So I think it's a very important briefing to get a sense of just what needs to be done, what we are doing, but most importantly, just the situation of these children in areas that have been cut off from support for a long, long time. So Sheldon is literally just back, so I'll throw to him now that he's in Port Sudan. Thank you. Over.
Thank you. Sheldon, welcome. Now you should be on. Go ahead.
Okay, now I'm on. Great. Thank you, colleagues, and good to be there. Thank you, James. Let me just cut to the chase. Over the past week, I traveled from Port Sudan to Al Jazeera and to Khartoum states, witnessing the impact that this crisis, the world's largest humanitarian crisis, is having on children and on families. During the mission, I saw homes and houses and buildings destroyed. I saw our warehouse in Khartoum looted and reduced to rubble. I saw our humanitarian supplies in that warehouse that had been destroyed. I saw communities uprooted and children who had been forced to flee and living now in overcrowded neighborhoods. I met mothers who walked for very long distances to find safety and health workers who cared for the sick and malnourished despite the risks. I also saw our teams and partners work tirelessly, often in perilous and uncertain conditions, continuing to deliver life-saving aid. I visited Jabal Orlia, one of the two localities in Khartoum State identified as of being at extreme risk of famine. Jabal Orlia and Khartoum localities carry 37% of the state's malnutrition burden. These localities are also the most impacted by the ongoing violence and access constraints. I witnessed firsthand how children have limited but growing access to safe water, to food, to healthcare, and to learning. Malnutrition is rife, and many of the children are reduced to just skin and bones. Children and families in the neighborhood are sheltered, often in small, damaged, or unfinished buildings. The roads are narrow, muddy, and often impassable, and getting more impassable by the day as the rains continue. Cholera spread rapidly in this neighborhood. The few functioning health centers and nutrition treatment centers in the area are highly congested and crammed with people. With our partners, we are doing everything we can. Security remains precarious, but it is improving. After months of effort, we finally have access to the community, and we continue to support health and nutrition services, water and sanitation, and reposition critical supplies where they are most needed. We are also creating safe spaces for children to learn, to play, and to heal. But the scale of this need is just staggering, and along with our partners, we're being stretched to the limit. Sadly, this is true across the country. With the situation deteriorating rapidly, children are dying from hunger, they're dying from disease, and they're dying from direct violence. They're being cut off from the very services that could save lives. This is not just hypothetical, it is a looming catastrophe. We are on the verge of irreversible damage to an entire generation of children. not because we lack the knowledge or the tools to save them, but because we are collectively failing to act with the urgency and scale this crisis demands. We need access to these children. With recent funding cuts, many of our partners in Khartoum and elsewhere in Sudan have been forced to scale back, and we're stepping up, but we cannot do it alone. We need resources and sustained access to be rapidly scaled up in the areas we can now reach. The record high admission rates of children receiving treatment for severe acute malnutrition in places like Jabalia and large parts of Al Jazeera State are clear signs the needs are staggering in the newly accessible areas. We must rapidly scale up life-saving services for children, and we need safe and sustained access to do whatever we must for children. This is particularly critical in areas in the front lines and currently cut off from aid, such as Al-Fashir, Diling, and Kadugli. Every day, without access to these places, puts children's lives at higher risk. As one of the displaced mothers told us, since this war started, my daughter has fallen into a state of silence, and I can feel her heart racing with fear. Her words are a chilling reminder of the invisible wounds this war is inflicting on children in Sudan. During this mission and a year later in Sudan, I have seen the worst of what war can do and the best of what humanity can offer in response. Children in Sudan are resilient. They have endured war now for over 2 years. They've endured displacement, hunger, and disease, but they cannot survive without help. We continue to call for sustained diplomatic efforts for peace. And while the conflict endures, we must collectively do everything in our power to support children. We cannot let them pay the ultimate price for it. The world must not look away, not now. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sheldon. Thanks for this incredibly important reminder of the situation of children there. And from children, we go to women with Salvador Nkurunziza and Sofia. Salvador, please.
Good morning, colleagues and the members of the press. Thank you for joining us today for this briefing on a deepening severe food insecurity crisis in Sudan. A crisis that is not only humanitarian, but profoundly gendered. Sudan is on the brink of famine, conflict, displacement, and economic collapse have pushed over 30 million people into acute food insecurity. But behind these numbers lies a stark and devastating truth. Women and girls are the hungriest face of this crisis. Since the conflict started in mid-April 2023, women and girls have been disproportionately affected by escalating food crisis. And with the conditions now near famine threshold in several regions in the country, it's not just food crisis, but gender emergencies caused by failure of gender responsive action. Women and girls are bearing the brunt of severe food insecurity with fewer resources, less access to aid, and a greater exposure to risks. According to the latest gender snapshot by the Gender in Humanitarian Action Working Group, 75% of female headed households in Sudan are now food insecure. The proportion facing severe food insecurity has nearly doubled in just 1 year, from 14% in 2024 to nearly 26% in 2025. Today, female headed households are three times more likely to be food insecure than those led by men. This is the result of systematic inequalities compounded by conflict and the displacement. Women are increasingly left to head households alone due to the death, displacement, disappearance, or forced displacement of male family members. And yet, they face the greatest barriers to food, income, and aid. Nearly half of the all female-headed households report poor food consumption. Only one third have access to an acceptable diet. And more than 70% of women nationally do not meet immediate dietary diversity, putting maternal and child health at grave risks. But amid this crisis, women are not only victims of conflict, they are also powerful agents of change. Women-led organizations are reaching last mile communities and saving lives, yet remain underfunded and excluded from key decision making. By supporting women-led organizations, we are strengthening the resilience of entire community. They are running food kitchens and delivering meals, yet remain underrecognized. One women-led organization operating across eight states was recently forced to shut down more than half of the food kitchen, not because the need diminished, but because the funding did. We must act, and we must act now. UN Women call for the following urgent actions. First, prioritize female-headed households and at-risk groups, including pregnant and breastfeeding women and adolescent girls in all food assistance. Two, fund and elevate women-led food support initiatives with flexible, direct, and predictable financing. Three, integrate women-led organizations into decision-making at all levels of humanitarian response. Four, link food assistance to protection and recovery, including gender-based violence mitigation and the women's livelihood. Five, track gender outcomes, not just output, because tonnage alone does not tell the full story. In closing, let us not wait for famine to be declared before we act. Let us listen to women, fund their leadership, and put gender equality at the heart of the response. Things are getting worse, but with bold, coordinated, and gender responsive action, we can turn the tide. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Salvatore, for this briefing. And before I open the floor to question, I just would like to remind you that OCHA's Director of Operations, Adem Wozornu, is in Sudan this week to assess the humanitarian situation. She will also meet with local officials, humanitarian partners, and people affected by the crisis. And Jens is with us if you have any question for him. So let me open now the floor to question. First in the room, Robin. Robin is our correspondent of AFP.
Good morning. Thank you, Salvatore and Sheldon. If you could both send your notes around, that would be greatly appreciated. A couple of questions for Sheldon. Why can't you get the access that you need? What is blocking things? And secondly, can you say a little bit more about what living through years of war has already done to the children of Sudan? Thank you.
Sheldon, we answer each question one after the other. Go ahead.
Thank you. You're asking what is blocking things. Well, this is Sudan. It's a massive country. We're on the cusp of the rainy season. Many roads are inaccessible already. That's an issue. We have vast distances. We have to negotiate each delivery with parties to the conflict, with the government. That is an issue. We can't just fill up a pickup truck or a 6-ton truck or a 10-ton truck with supplies and send it down the road. Of course, we need to get permission to do that. That takes time. All of these issues. And of course, some areas have been under siege. And we have, despite months of trying, we have not been able to get supplies to those areas. We've had our convoys have been hit by drones. They've been destroyed. That's an issue as well.
It's okay. Yeah, go ahead.
And you asked
your second question. Sorry,
The second question on, and if I, what else? Paraphrase your second question, please.
Go ahead, Robin.
Yeah, I was asking if you could say a little bit more about the impact that living through years of war has already had on the children of Sudan.
Yeah, I mean, the scar tissue, the emotional scar tissue is massive. The fact that children don't know exactly where they're going next. I met children who have been displaced four or five times. As the front lines have changed, they've had to go and stay with one host community to another host community to another host community, always feeling like, despite the welcoming atmosphere, often feeling like aliens in their own land. They've had to be integrated into other schools, to other services. They've had been often not received the nutritional support they require, received the educational support. We know that some 80% of children in this country are not in school. Most schools are not functioning. That's going to have an impact for generation after generation.
Thank you very much. Other questions in the room? Yes, Olivia, Reuters.
Good morning. Thank you for this briefing. A few questions from me for both of you. First of all, if you could just outline what your funding shortfall actually is. You were saying about funding cuts. It'd be great just to have some figures to illustrate that, both for UNICEF and UN Women. Dovetailing on what Robin was asking about access, are you able just to name a few of the areas that are still under siege where you cannot access currently? And just a final question to get a better sense of the main issue in terms of malnutrition and treating that. Is the issue that you're facing, is it because, for example, you have shortages of like life-saving therapeutic foods, or is the issue more on the health center side? You said they were overwhelmed. And is that due to cuts, or was that already a kind of previous legacy issue? But just a bit more detail explaining why you're concerned there and what's actually hampering your efforts to treat children. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Sorry, Sheldon. Maybe I give you both the floor, and then we also have Jens, who might have more on the funding issue, if you want to come to the podium, Jens. Sheldon, and then Salvatore, and then Jens.
Yeah, thank you. We only have roughly a quarter of the funds that we require. This is a massive emergency, one of the largest, if not the largest, humanitarian emergencies in the world. And of course, there are children elsewhere who are also on page one or two, rather than page 36 of the world's newspapers. So funding has not come at the degree that is required given the extent of this crisis. You asked about malnutrition, why it's there. I think it's for a variety of reasons. Obviously, in some cases, it's complete lack of access. We have not had access to the horrible situation unfolding in Al-Fashir, for example. Despite trying for months and months and months, we have not been able to get supplies there. In other places, also in the quarter funds, access has remained very, very difficult because of growing insecurity in the region. We just can't get our trucks in at the volume and at the level that is required given the needs there. We also have the compounding effects of poor water and sanitation, of cholera, of acute watery diarrhea. These things also contribute to malnutrition. We have markets that are not functioning. And we have children not being able to go to the health centers to get the screening. In Jabal Ilia, for example, we've seen a massive increase in children now going to the centers. Huge lines, huge demand, because it's been pent-up demand. The problem is, malnutrition can't wait. We need to get children on a regular basis, on a consistent basis, on a predictable basis to the screening that they require. Children die if they're cut off from supplies for months and months and end.
Salvatore, you want to add something to that on your side, on the funds especially? We can't hear you, sorry. Can you? Yeah, no, it's fine.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think my colleague Sheldon mentioned it. Access, particularly in the northern, southern, and the western region, you have to be recognized that it's still under siege. The conflict, the war is still ongoing, particularly in the Kordofan and the El Fasher, that is still has been for quite a long time under siege. This is, of course, have impact on access to not only the humanitarian assistance, but also access to social services like health, education, that my colleague mentioned. So this is, as I mentioned, women and girls are the most disproportionately affected by the conflict, which again impacts also the capability to access food, in addition to the environmental and the climate change issues that actually lead to food insecurity. Most of the households are now female-headed households, as I mentioned, with very less support. The only frontline workers is a women-led organizations that unfortunately are less funded in terms of support, which making their capacity to respond and support to the women households very, very difficult. You ask a question about the financial cut. Obviously, the humanitarian assistance funding is still less than 25% as we speak, which in many cases related to the financial cut. But the cut also impact the UN agencies and the humanitarian organizations' capacities in terms of personnel, staff, humanitarian workers to actually be deployed and access where needs is required.
Jens?
Over to you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning, everyone. Just to your question, Olivia, the Global Humanitarian Response Plan with all the UN agencies and NGOs coordinated by OCHA is asking 4.16 billion for this year. We've up to now received 23%. But when I talk about funding, we always have to talk about access as well, because funding without access or access without funding, none of that makes sense. You need to have both. And that's why we also hear from our briefers today from Port Sudan, access is really key. And if I could just mention one thing, it was briefly mentioned, but the epicenter of this is still in Darfur and around El Fasher. It is now 1 year since famine was confirmed in the Samsam camp just outside of El Fasher, and no transport of food or other commodities by road has reached that area for 1 year. So that El Fasher remains under siege. That is the ultimate no access statement. So of course we engage at all levels and discussions continue to get this access. And we cannot wait for another year. We need that access now. Thank you.
Indeed. If there are no other questions in the room, let me go to the platform. Jamie Keaton, Associated Press.
Thank you, Alessandra, and thank you for the presentations. I'm glad that Jens came up to the dais, because I think this question may also be up his alley. I have several questions. The first is about El Fasher, as you just mentioned. Some people there who have been impacted by starvation have been pleading for airdrops to happen in Sudan along the way that they've been happening in Gaza, for example. Do aid groups see this as a feasible option, and what would be the challenges in achieving that? Second question is maybe for Salvatore or for Mr. Yet. What is the latest estimate of women and children that are impacted by food insecurity in North Darfur and Kordofan, where, of course, the fighting has intensified in the last few months? And if I could just slide in a third one, Farhan Haq, the deputy spokesman in New York, yesterday said that heavy fighting in North Darfur has left civilian casualties in recent days. Do you have any estimate of the number of people and killed, and how many of those are women and children? Thank you.
Okay, many questions. Who would like to start? Can you? Yeah, go ahead, Sheldon.
Yes, thank you. Maybe I'll say something about airdrops in Al-Fasher. Look, we've looked at all possibilities here. It does not seem to be a realistic possibility right now of doing airdrops right there. Obviously, in order to do that, you need to ensure the supplies get to specifically the population who need the most, and to the children, the women, those who are most malnourished and most affected by the crisis, not to those who are perpetuating the crisis. You also have to ensure that planes can safely fly and can drop the supplies and can target them. Those conditions do not seem to be in place right now in Al-Fasher. We continue to work with and to call on the government and all parties to the conflict to let supplies in, to ensure that supplies get where they need to go, to ensure that innocent women and children and all populations in need get the humanitarian support they require.
Salvador or Jens, you want to add anything? I see, Salvador, you wanted to speak, but you have to unmute.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, on the data question, how many women and girls affected, there are in total about 30 million in need of humanitarian assistance.
Sorry, can you repeat the figure? We couldn't hear you well.
Yeah, there is about more than 30.4 million
okay.
in need of humanitarian assistance. Out of them, 15.3 million are women and girls, from whom the female household are 25%. As you, in the case of the in need of secure in a situation of severe food insecurity. Again, Kordofan, Darfur regions are the most affected by the food insecurity, which means that, which shows that out of the 5.4 million of IDPs, internal displaced populations, 75% female household are actually in the severe food insecurity. That's to give an idea about how many the proportion of the food insecurity in the most, unfortunately, accessible difficulties areas in Darfur, mainly in the El-Fasher and the Kordofan and the north and the south regions. Now, in terms of the possibility of airlifting, of course, that can be an option explored, but we have to mention also that is still an area where fighting still continue with the drone shield. Of course, who knows whether they even airlifting will not be intercepted before they even lift the food assistance. It's a very dire situation that requires non-international community. And of course, press for peace process to get this lasting peace for this region. And as UN Women, we keep advocating for real access to women and support the women-led organizations that regardless the access of the humanitarian communities, they remain on the front line providing assistance with the limited, unfortunately, resources and aid.
Thank you very much. And I take the opportunity maybe to ask James and also Aijamal to send out to the journalists the notes. And for example, now Salvador has given a lot of figures, so it would be interesting to have them in writing. Jens, you want to compliment? I see then Jamie has a follow-up.
No,
it's okay. So let's go to Jamie. Jamie, we haven't answered all your questions.
Yeah, thank you. I didn't hear any numbers about the estimates of the number of people killed and how many of those are women and children in North Darfur in recent days. And just to Mr. Nkurunziza, I didn't quite understand the number that you were saying was the latest estimate of women that were impacted by food security. You said 75% of 5.4 million were 75% were female headed households, if I understood that correctly, which would put us at about 4 million. Is that right? I mean, could you just basically, I'm just looking specifically for the estimate of women that are affected and children from Mr. Yet, of people impacted by food security in North Darfur and Kordofan.
Okay, on the first point of the fighting.
Can I deal?
Yeah, go ahead. Salvatore, sorry, I thought you said you were going to take the floor, or Sheldon, or Jens, anybody has more details on this? You didn't hear the question. So it was
no,
about...
No, I was on mute. I couldn't talk.
Go ahead. Go ahead. We listen.
Thank you. No, I mean, we're seeing reports as well on casualties. We know that we've heard of health centers being hit, education centers being hit, markets being hit. We get reports of casualties on a regular basis. We don't have verified numbers ourselves just yet. What we're seeing is the anecdotal information that we're getting from other partners on the ground from others there, but I can't give you specific numbers of exact numbers of women and children particularly. I can tell you that North Darfur continues to be the epicenter of hunger, the epicenter of needs for humanitarian needs, particularly for children, and that's the area we're most concerned about.
Thank you. Salvatore, can you clarify your figures, please, for Jamie?
Well, as also mentioned by my colleague, it's very difficult to have accurate information. As we speak, UN Women is collecting information and the data that will be published very recent in the coming weeks on gender alert that focusing mainly on food insecurity and including in the most affected and inaccessible regions in Darfur and Kordofan. As I mentioned, there's about 15.3 million women and girls in need of assistance. This is a national figures. However, the majority, the population affected by food insecurity, they are again, unfortunately, in the Darfur regions, Kordofan and regions, where we estimate that 5.54 billion in the IDP camps that are in the northern. But I will be able to give you a correct figure. We share this with the data, and we share also the gender alerts that we come with the more accurate figures, particularly concerning the Darfur region, Kordofan, and other most food insecure regions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Last question from Gabriela Sotomayor, Proceso.
Thank you. Thank you very much for this briefing. My question is for Jens. If you have, Jens, any information on the migrants that were deported from USA to Sudan, these were Venezuelan migrants, they were not criminals. So I don't know if the authorities of Sudan, they agreed to receive these people. Do you know anything about them? Thank you so much.
Yeah, Babares just come to the podium, so maybe more than Jens, he can say something. I leave him one moment. The question was...
Good morning, Jens. Thank you. I would need to check with colleagues and get back.
And maybe, Gabriela, ask the question also to our colleagues to at IOM. But yeah, thank you, Babar. If there are no other questions on Sudan for our colleagues, and I don't see other hands up, so thank you very much. And I count on Aishamal and James to send you the notes. Thanks so much, Sheldon. Thanks so much, Salvatore. And good luck with your important work. And come back and update us as soon as you can. So I'll turn now to Babar for UNHCR. And Babar is also on displaced people, but we're speaking here about Pakistan and Afghan refugees. Please.
Thank you, Alexandra. Good morning, dears. We bring you another worrying update, this time from Pakistan, and this is linked with registered Afghan refugees that have been living in Pakistan for decades. UNHCR, the UN refugee agency, expresses its concern over Pakistan's intention to forcibly return Afghan refugees, or registered Afghan refugees holding proof of registration cards, which are known as POR cards. This is the legal name of the document. On July 31st, Pakistan confirmed that Afghan refugees would be repatriated under its ongoing illegal foreigners repatriation plan. Over the past days, UNHCR has received reports of arrest and detention of Afghans across the country, including those of registered refugees who hold POR cards. And the number of registered refugees at this point in Pakistan is 1.3 million. They're part of more than 2 million Afghans who are currently in Pakistan. UNHCR acknowledges and appreciates Pakistan's generosity in hosting refugees for over 40 years amidst its own challenges. However, given those holding registered refugee cards have been recognized as refugees for decades, their forced return is contrary to Pakistan's long-standing humanitarian approach to this group and would constitute a violation of the principle of non-refoulement. UNHCR remains particularly concerned about women and girls forced to return to a country where their human rights are at risk, as well as other groups who might be in danger if they were forced to return. We call on the authorities in Pakistan to ensure that any return of Afghans back to Afghanistan is voluntary, safe, and dignified. UNHCR has continued to seek an extension of validity of the POR cards, which are the registered cards for refugees, and welcomes the additional 1 month grace period that Pakistan has granted, as we understand today. UNHCR strongly urges the government of Pakistan to apply measures to exempt Afghans with continued international protection needs from involuntary return. We also appeal to Pakistan's established goodwill to allow legal stay for Afghans with medical needs, those currently pursuing higher education or in mixed marriages. UNHCR has expressed its readiness to support Pakistan to establish necessary mechanisms. The large-scale return of Afghans this year from neighboring countries has put immense pressure on basic services, housing, and livelihoods, and the host communities themselves, worsening an already dire humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. Mass and hasty returns significantly heighten protection needs and risks instability in Afghanistan and in the wider region, including the risk of onward movement. This year alone, over 2.1 million Afghans have already returned or have been forced to return to Afghanistan. This includes 352,000 from Pakistan, the figure of 2.1 million from both Iran and Pakistan also include a large number that have been deported back to Afghanistan. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Babar. Any question to UNHCR in the room? Let me look. Yes, Robin.
Morning, Baba. Is the government in Pakistan fully aware of your concerns about the principle of non-refoulement, and what's the sort of state of the discussions that you're having with the government of Pakistan?
Thank you, Robin. We are in continuous contact with the authorities, both in Pakistan and government, and trying to highlight the dire humanitarian and human rights situation inside Afghanistan. There's Afghans could face if they are forced to return back. The worry at this stage in Pakistan, because this is a really new development, Pakistan has been pushing pressure on undocumented Afghans, and this plan that we refer to has been in place since 2023, but mostly aimed for illegal or undocumented Afghans. This is a registered refugee population. They are well documented, and they have been there for decades. I remember being part of the registration exercise in 2006 in Pakistan when we did this exercise, and it meant to provide the required protection that Afghans needed. And over the decades, the situation, sadly, in Afghanistan has not improved. It just, every turn makes it more worse for Afghanistan, not only inside their own country, but in the region as well. So the appeal is for compassion, the appeal for continued protection for all those that require it. And I think colleagues have been bringing issues that Afghans who return back to the country are facing. Today, there are more than 23 million Afghans that need humanitarian support inside the country. Only this year, we have seen 2.1 million more returned from the two neighboring countries. It's a huge pressure on the structures inside the country, but also on the ability of humanitarian organizations to keep supporting those who are returning. And also, on top of this, is no resources available as well. So the funding cuts and drops are also immensely affecting us and Afghans.
Very clear. Thank you, Babar, for this clarification. Any other question? Nick Amimbrus.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for the briefing, and thanks for taking the question. Babar, I just wanted to check what's happened to the people who've gone back already. How many are now actually in camps? Quite a lot have been absorbed back into the communities, I understand it, but presumably there is a huge overflow population in camps. How big is that? And is that, if you're facing a return of another million or two people, what how do you see that inflow being dealt with? Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. Two aspects of the question. One is where Afghans are in the two neighboring countries, Iran and Pakistan, where we have a large Afghan refugee population and other Afghans who are there to seek safety. Iran is primarily an urban situation for Afghans. 99% of Afghans who are in Iran live in cities. So the profile is very different. Pakistan is another story. Currently, we have 1.3 million registered refugees, and majority of them have been in refugee camps. These were established in early 1980s, which have now become small towns or settlements at this point. Those who have been returning back to Afghanistan this year, out of the 2.1 million, 1.7 have returned from Iran, either pushed or pressured or deported. So they have come through the Western Islam Kala border with Iran, which is very close to the western city of Herat. And then they have been going mostly to urban center like Kabul, like Herat and Kunduz and other places. those returnees or those who have been pushed or pressured back from Pakistan, they may go to more urban areas. And UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, we have been with Afghans during this last 2 decades, but also for the last 4 decades during different return periods. And we have literally helped them reestablish their lives in their communities where their regions are from. But it's not an easy job for Afghans to do. If you have lived all your life in another country and you're just hastily been asked to leave, or been forced to leave or have been brought to the border to be deported, it's a huge challenge. It is a humanitarian crisis, an individual crisis for many of those Afghans who have been pressured to return back. So there's very little chance for this population to reintegrate, to reestablish themselves. On top of it, I mean, if you're a family with women and girls who were in educational institutions in the neighboring countries, how do you resume education for your children in an environment like Afghanistan?
Follow up, Nick.
One quick follow up, and that is, what is the inflow from Iran still going on at the previous rate? You talked previously, I think, of up to 50,000 people a day. How's the flow proceeding now? Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. When we talked about the 50,000 a day, it was 4th of July, if I remember correctly. Since then, it has not slowed down to the levels that we saw earlier in the year, which was an average of 2,000, 3,000 returns each day. It has still stayed in the range of above 20,000, 229,000 and 30,000. So we can still say that thousands of Afghans are still returning from Iran. And that figure for this year from Iran stands at 1.7 million. In the past couple of months, we have at least seen 1 million Afghans returning from Iran or been forced to return, and majority of them were those that were deported.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Yeah, John.
Hi, Babar. For the 1.4 million Pakistanis who hold the proof of registration cards, or sorry, Afghans who hold proof of registration cards from Pakistan, now that the cards have expired, might there be any effort by UNHCR to issue a substitute card, sort of like the Nansen passport?
Thank you, John. So the registration exercise, when this was done with the Pakistani authorities, Pakistan has a national database and registration authority which keeps count of its own nationals. But we then, back in 2006 and 2007, we worked with them to document all Afghans which were on Pakistan's territory. So this is a recognized legal document which has date of validity. In this case, the proof of registration's validity was till end of the June, and this has been the case. Pakistan has been revising and renewing it. So now we are also in touch with the authorities that, yes, we welcome the grace period of a month for these Afghans, but the need for protection, the need for international protection for Afghans who are in Pakistan, that has not gone away. So please reconsider that, and we are willing and ready to work with the Pakistani authorities as in the past to put in place mechanism, get a new renewal for Afghans who have been documented and legally living in the country.
Thank you very much. I don't see other questions. Babar, thanks for this detailed and important briefing. That concludes our topics of today. I got a few announcements for you. First of all, I don't think anybody at the Palais this morning may have missed what's happening in the Assembly Hall. You all know that we have opened this morning the second part of the fifth session of the Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee on Plastic Pollution. It was on all your media today. I remind you that today at 1:15, you'll hear everything about the conference from Inger Andersen, the executive director of UNEP, together with Luis Valles Valdivieso, the chair of the Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee, and Katrin Schneeberger, director of the Federal Office of the Environment of Switzerland, and Gioti Mathur-Philipp, who is the executive secretary of the committee. And that gives me also the opportunity. So that will be here in person and online on the from the press room. That gives me also the opportunity to say that thanks to our colleagues of security, during the time of the conference, if you're working on the conference late, or if you're working on the conference on Saturday, you don't need to write to me or to Rolando to ask permission to stay either longer on Saturday, as for the time of the conference we have an agreement with security that journalists can stay at the palette late and can also come on Saturday. So for these two timings, you don't need to write to us. You're welcome to work from the palette in conjunction with the conference. There is also on the web, there is also draft schedule that you may find. It's regularly updated on the Live Daily Schedule webpage, and they also have a mobile app of the conference, and the daily schedule is published the night before to the night for the day after. So that is what I have on the conference. I'm pretty sure you will hear much more interesting things from our colleagues at lunchtime today. The fact that tomorrow, the 6th of August, is the International Day of Awareness of the Special Development Needs and Challenges of Landlocked Developing Countries gives me the opportunity to remind you that the Secretary General is currently in Awaza, in Turkmenistan, where he is attending the 3rd UN Conference on Landlocked Developing Countries. And he has spoken this morning at the opening session. You have the remarks in your mailbox, where he said that he addressed the challenges facing landlocked developing countries, such as the steep barriers to trade, the high transport costs, and the limited access to global market. And he also spoke about solutions to overcome these obstacles. I think this is all I had for you. I don't know if there are any questions in the room. Yes, Olivia?
Thank you, Alessandra. This is actually for Jens and UNICEF, if possible, if I'm able to ask. UNICEF, if possible. I think James is on the call still, hopefully. It's on Gaza.
James is still there. Let's see. Let me see. While Jens is coming to the podium, let me check if he isn't, but I can try to reconnect. Or maybe I will just bring the question to him. But Jens, can you come please back? Give him a second.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks very much. This is on Gaza. If you could please, Jens, and also eventually James, just outline what, if any, improvements there have been since Israel introduced new measures to get aid into the Gaza Strip, and also what your reaction is today to the news that some commercial supplies will be allowed in. And just secondly, we've spoken, I know, a lot about malnutrition, but just keen to get an update on the water situation as well in Gaza. What is the current level of concern, and have you seen any improvements given that some fuel has now got into the strips, to the strip, but also if issues like contamination still continue to be an issue? And if you have any figures, particularly on the first question, that would be helpful too. Thank you.
Thank you, Jens. I give the floor to you, and I've sent a message, urgent message to James, see if he can reconnect.
Yeah, thank you. I don't feel safe without James, as you know. So, but let me see what I can do about these unilateral pauses. Unilateral pauses. It's important to mention that aid has gone in, you know, with dozens of trucks per day, right? The needs inside Gaza is such that there should be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and more hundreds of trucks. Not only every day, not only every week, but for months, possibly years to come. This has been building up. We are now on the brink of famine, as you know. That is not something that happens overnight. It builds up. And to get yourself out of that, it takes a long time to refeed people, simply put it, to put it bluntly, and other kinds of aid. So while we have had some come in, it remains far insufficient to the needs. And I hope you understand that the magnitude, that the difference between this very small amount of aid that has now come in, and everybody expect me to clap and say thank you, and the massive needs that are there, where people are literally dying on a daily basis. It's out of proportion. So I wanted to say that. But again, we have welcomed the forces. We continue to welcome these forces. We will do everything we can to get aid in and get it distributed safely. To the commercial supplies, that is also, I would say, welcome news. That is something we have said for a very long time. We've always pointed out that aid alone cannot fix the problem. There needs to be a commercial supply going in as well. Well, bearing in mind, commercial supplies cost money for people. Aid is free of charge. And we have thousands of tons of aid, including food aid, standing just outside of Gaza, which has already been paid for by the donors. And donors expect that to be given free of charge to the people in need. And it's our job to do so, but we are not getting the facilitation that we need to do so. So that is what I can say to that. On water and fuel, yes, I also saw that there were, I think there were four trucks that was coming in. Again, that's great, but it is only four trucks. And we need a lot more to get the supplies up so that there can be a continuous flow of clean and safe water for everybody.
Thank you very much, Jens. And James is coming to your rescue. He's here. James, sorry. Just to say that Olivia was asking whether you could say something about the fact that some of the infant formula, other biscuits for children, or other food for children has come in, and if it makes any difference and how you see the situation is evolving. And water, too. You were there. I can't see you anymore. There you are.
I'm here, Alexandra. I'm sorry about that. Can you repeat the question?
Just if you could say something about the fact that some infant formula, some food for pregnant women, water has come in into the Gaza Strip. How do you see the situation for children in relation with this few commodities that have made it into the strip?
I think far too little. I think it would be a mistake, because we've seen it so many times, it would be a mistake to relax or to be full of praise or even hope for this drip, drip, drip of humanitarian aid, because we've been here before. And it's almost like a game that is being played, and there's such an immense amount of deprivation, and then some aid comes in, and you know the there is a sense from through the world's press that things are improving, and that therefore people take their eyes off again. But of course, everyone here knows that it was a limit of 500 trucks a day. That really now needs to be probably twice that amount. So if we've got 80 or 100 trucks a day, it's not nearly enough. And yes, there's some infant formula. Yes, there is an improvement in water. It's still 96% of households having an insufficient amount of water. So I think we've been here before. We've talked about a pier. We've talked about aid drops. We talked about the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. We've counted trucks ad nauseum. Everyone should now realize that unless there is sustained humanitarian aid by those actors who do this, we just heard from Sudan, by those actors who do this around the world, then we will see horrific results in the next IPC. We may already see those. So we need a much greater amount of humanitarian aid allowed in by those actors who do it and have done it around the world. We need many, many more routes. We need much more safety on the ground. All this, again, I guess, points, Alessandra, to a ceasefire. But in the absence of that, no, I don't think that we can claim any moment of hope or pause when we see some baby formula getting in. When we see food coming in that supports 30,000 children, what we really should realise is that there's still 970,000 children not getting enough. So at the moment, it is, as we've heard from Tom Fletcher, it's a drop in the ocean, and that's a line we've heard far too frequently, and it's a line we hear because it's absolutely spot on.
Mohammed, Olivia has a follow-up, and I'll come to you after.
Thank you so much, both of you. And James, just a quick follow-up, just specifically on water. I remember recently you warned about a man-made drought happening, a risk of happening in Gaza. Is that still your assessment? If you could just outline your level of concern, given the current context, what you've seen in the past week in terms of some supplies getting in and some fuel. And also just curious on the point of whether the issue is access in terms of just water at all and people going thirsty, or whether it's kind of a contamination risk, or maybe both, if you could just explain in some detail. Thank you.
Yeah, I saw your note, Olivia, to speak this afternoon. I'd rather do that. This is literally my first day back after a couple of weeks. So things change so quickly in Gaza. And I do know that there has been a slight change in the last couple of days on the water supply, which again is all around intent. That is the intent of Israel to allow more water in, more drinking water into the civilians in Gaza. So I'd rather not go into that detail now, but will happily do so this afternoon and can do again next Friday. But I'm just trying to gather that information now.
Mohammed.
Thank you so much, Alessandra. My question is also for James. Israeli government says there is no famine in Gaza and children are not dying because of malnutrition. Do you agree with this? And what would you like to say about this topic?
Look, the good thing with the United Nations, whether it's UNICEF, OCHA, World Food Programme, WHO, the good thing is that we have two very strong elements in everything we do. One is the data, and that's we'll see that again from the IPC, and you saw the last IPC and how dire that is, and we'll see again next week. So one is very, very comprehensive evidence, and the other is eyes on the ground. And both those things speak to a horrific situation. We've seen a great deal, a spike in the number of children who are considered to have starved to death. Now, remembering that the vast majority of children who are severely malnourished will die of another cause, that they are 10 times more likely to die of a pneumonia or measles or something, that is happening. Very hard to record those deaths at the moment. Most of those children don't get to hospitals. We've spoken before about, say, Nasser Hospital in the south, the only fully functioning hospital in the south. It's also surrounded by evacuation orders. So families have malnourished children. It's very, very difficult for them to get through areas that are not deconflicted to a hospital. So we don't quite know. So I think UNICEF would like to feel now that after 22 months of this, of an overwhelming amount of evidence, overwhelming amount of testimonials, overwhelming amount of data, an overwhelming amount of video and footage from the ground, that we no longer have to, you know, go tete-a-tete when it comes to statements from officials. We can simply let facts speak on the ground. And the facts are that we have seen three full aid blockades and now another virtual blockade. We have a humanitarian population in unprecedented levels of malnutrition, lack of water access, and remembering a bombardment. Many, many times we have these conversations, and I think it's very important that there is an increasing amount of pressure now from many governments because of the deprivations, because of the nutritional situation we see in children and in mothers and in women and in the elderly. We mustn't forget as well, though, that on average, a girl or a boy has been killed in this bombardment every single hour since the horrors of October 7. So the facts speak for themselves, and I think it's not helpful to take on, you know, to take on statements made from political leaders when, of course, there are so many other statements made equally by political leaders that speak very clearly to what the intents are of the restrictions and the blockade of humanitarian aid and the continued bombardment of places that civilians seek safety in.
Thank you very much. Nick?
Yeah, thank you. A question for Jens and possibly for James, if you've got some information on this. But we had President Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, visiting the GSF operation recently. We hear there's a plan in the works to resolve the humanitarian crisis. I just wanted to ask, Jens, did Steve Witkoff have any contact with UN officials or any of the UN aid agencies during his visit? And has there been any kind of active engagement with UN humanitarian agencies on the plan that they're putting together? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Nick. I don't know if there has been at this point. It's not something that I have confirmed. There is a continuous dialogue, of course, with the United States, and we wish any attempt to create a ceasefire and create the conditions whereby we can work as welcome. We wish them luck. Let me put it like that. Now, I think it's worth bearing in mind, and also to Mohammed's question, whether we agree with the Israelis or not. I think there's one person I agree with today, and he said that a week ago, and that was President Trump. He said there's real starvation in Gaza. You remember that? I think that's worth remembering. So if I get any updates of any meetings that we can speak about, Nick, I will let you know.
Thank you very much. No more hands up for anybody. So thank you very much. I think I'll see you all at 1:15 here for the press conference and otherwise on Friday for the press briefing. Thank you very much for being with us today. Thanks.